When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try Maintain X for free today. Go to maintainx.com/AI. That's maintain in the letter x.com/AI.
At Vistaprint, we know you've got that idea for your business. Like the one that nails the trade show, levels up your brand, or makes your team say,
"We're really doing this."
But an idea is just an idea until it's printed on
signage, giveaways, custom apparel.
Once it's
in my hands, on my team, out in the world,
then it's happening.
It's so happening.
Vistaprint has thousands of products, easy design tools, and real support to turn that idea into something possible. Print your possible with code NEW20 for 20% off your first order at Vistaprint.com.
Summer break is here. I want my kids to have fun, but I also want them to keep their skills sharp. Between vacations and sports, I need something that fits our busy schedule without adding stress. That's why we use IXL. IXL is an award-winning online platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized, interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's proven to improve grades, and one subscription covers every child in the home, saving us time and money. It's trusted nationwide. And in fact, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
The days are longer, the calendar's filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grunes. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber. So I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing. They're easy to toss in my bag on the go. Plus, they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA-FSA eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code podcast at grunes.co. That's code podcast at GRUNS.co.
James Baldwin once said that success, more like the spotlight, is the enemy of writers, because the whole thing is that we're not supposed to know anything. How James Baldwin said is that we're supposed to approach the typewriter, right? In his time, it was the typewriter. For me, it's the keyboard. Right. That we're supposed to approach the page in a state of unknowing, in a state of hoping to figure it out by the time you're done.
Yeah.
And fame kind of robs you of that a little bit, because you're expected to have the answers.
Right.
You're expected to not make mistakes. And becoming a public figure means you make your mistakes in public, and you're afforded less grace, and that's painful.
Yo, welcome to another episode of Intimate with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the heart of LA, here in the I Am Studios. And I am with storyteller, author, poet, founder of the poetry collective Chingona Fire, best-selling author, winner of the International Latino Book Award for Poetry, Yessica Salgado.
Hello.
Hello. And she is the author not just of Corazon, but also Tesoro and Hermosa. Three excellent, stunning collections.
Thank you.
Kind of redefines for me, you know, I'm not a poetry aficionado, but redefines for me modern Los Angeles-based mm-hmm. poetry. And I remember my first, and I had been aware of you, but I saw you. I went with my wife and her family to the Ballet Folklorico at the Ford Theater.
Oh, that was a special night.
It was an awesome night. So great, first of all, great venue. One of my favorite venues.
Yeah, beautiful venue.
So intimate, so gorgeous. But you, I think you closed out the show, if I'm not, did you close or did you open?
I was a guest. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you.
No.
I was a guest. The mariachi that has that night is, I'm blanking on the name. Hold on.
Colibri.
Yes, Colibri.
Yeah.
Las Colibri. Amazing, amazing. We were paired together to do something at Hauser and Worth.
Yeah.
But I performed with Sancha. Shout out to Sancha, my beloved diva. She is a beautiful, beautiful singer. Powerful performer. She like mixes so many genres into one. But when we perform together, she does Spanish ballads.
Yeah.
You know, we cover a lot of Juan Gabriel, Selena, Los Terricolas. And we take these love songs that are familiar to us and nostalgic.
Yeah.
And we interweave my poems with them. And so we had our own show at Hauser and Worth.
Yeah.
And they brought the mariachi in as our guest. And they enjoyed working with us so much. And they had us as their guest at the Ford. But ended up giving us like a chunk of like 20 or 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Like their whole night. And it was just really awesome. Sancho was climbing up on stuff she wasn't supposed to climb up on. It's just, it was just a night.
360 degree. Well, it was like most of the all over the place. I remember that. And it was, okay, so let me explain this. And again, I'm going to be honest here. I'm not like into poetry, quote unquote, though I am a hip hop guy and I kind of understand, you know, I used to write lyrics and stuff like that in the 90s.
You're there already.
I always thought hip hop and poetry, look, they're definitely cousins. Mm-hmm. They're definitely adjacent. But to think of myself as a poet, no way. Because poet is so much artistry, so much soul, so much heart. Tell me first and foremost, what is poetry to you?
I mean, I think it just for that, for hip hop, it uses a lot of the devices that we use in poetry.
Yeah.
It uses rhyme, meter. You also use a lot of alliteration. You use a lot of metaphors throughout hip hop. And hip hop was just poetry put to a beat. But for me, poetry is the expression.
Yeah.
It's expression and it has many different forms. And there's what people study in school that I feel is what keeps people from poetry. Because you're reading these old white dead dudes that like not everybody connects with.
This is it, right? That's why you're like, no, poetry's whack. Like, oh my God. Like, so, I mean, you know? In that sense. In that sense.
In that sense, yeah. Because you're reading somebody that's writing about a frozen flower, you know, and you're like, we're in LA, how are we going to connect with like a frozen daisy, you know?
It's like art when you see a still life. You're like, this is art. And it's like some oranges and apples in like a basket. And you're like, I mean, I guess that's pretty, but like, come on. Yeah, go.
But I think modern poetry in the way that we know, in the 50s, in the 1950s, confessionalist poetry became really popularized. What, you know, like Sylvia Plath is one of like the biggest folks that you know there. And so the fact that that became popular to center yourself in the work, it really wasn't happening previously before that.
Okay.
And so now in this social media time where folks are writing, it is very personal and very self, like the self narrative drives it. So I think in modern times, people go to poetry looking for themselves. They want to see themselves in something. And so when I'm writing and also when I facilitate a lot of writing workshops and when I work with these young writers or newer writers, I just tell them like, your whole job is to tell a story. Yeah, you're using poetic devices, but it's just like being as honest and present as possible. We have so much stuff in the world like that's just distracting us from everything.
Correct.
That like something simple cuts through the noise. And that's, at least I hope that that's what my poetry is doing.
I'll tell you what your poetry is doing for me is it's powerful. It's deep. It's almost defiant. Like I feel like when I'm and again, it's like, there's not a lot of poets that I can even name or that resonate with me. But when I see your work, it's like, and I know it's not necessarily even directed at me, but it's something that's so genuine and so heartfelt that I'm like, wow, this is really, really powerful. Where does that come from? What is?
Well, I like that you called it defiant because it is in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that I'm a career writer is wild. I'm a high school dropout. I really didn't finish high school in
Marshall High School, by the
Marshall
way.
Marshall High School.
Just for the record. Very, very accomplished high school. I want to say Leonardo DiCaprio.
Marshall High School sent me off to continuation school. They were like, we don't know what to do with you. You're going to continuation school. But if you look up their Wikipedia in their celebrity alumni, I'm there. So Marshall.
Now they're trying to claim you.
Give me my diploma. No, but they've had me back. I went to go speak to their freshman class last year, which was really fun. And my niece is a freshman there now, and she's upset that I haven't gone this year. But soon enough. Bring me back. But so the fact that, like, I'm self-taught. I learned how to about poetry by, like, reading. I have vivid memories of reading, pulling a bunch of poems off of the bookshelf at the library, at Coango Branch Library.
Yeah.
On Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And one of the first collections that I read was Nikki Giovanni. And then when I was 16, I started writing poetry when I was, I think what? Like, I don't know if I knew that I was writing poems, but I was writing since I learned how to read and write.
Right.
Okay. And then I started getting Maya Angelou, Nikki Giovanni, which were the common names that I got introduced to.
Right.
And then when I was 16, I was going through my first heartbreak and my Chicano, well, he's a Chicano, but one of my history teachers, he handed me a copy of Sandra Cisneros. I don't remember if it was My Wicked, Wicked Ways or Loose Woman.
Yeah.
But he handed me a copy of Sandra Cisneros' poems, and that just, like, opened up a door that I was already writing. I had already been in the poetry club at King Middle School.
Represent, yeah.
And then we had done a reading at Skylight Bookstore. So the first place I ever read poems out loud was at Skylight.
Wow. As a youngster?
Like a 13-year-old.
That's guts right there. Yeah.
I don't think I knew what I was doing. And then in high school, I was part of a writing group. And then we had an assembly where we were reading poems. And I read a 7-page poem.
Oh, my.
About my ex-boyfriend. And he was in, and he was in one of the assemblies. Yeah. And I was just like, you smell. And I went, you smell like Cheeto, like Flaming Hots, cigarettes and cool water. Like, I thought it was romantic.
Yeah.
I was talking about those.
It is, though. It's real.
It was real. Yeah. And so I learned a lot of what I do in my craft through reading whoever I wanted to read and also through music. I grew up on, like, Juan Gabriel and Los Bukis, all these Spanish lyricists like Marco Antonio Solís, you know, John Sebastian, these great lyricists, and listening to that music always moved me to want to emulate that. And trust me, if I had been born with the singing talents, I would not have been a poet.
That's actually fair, because that's a good sort of segue. The music, I guess, was the inspiration for you. Obviously, you're reading and doing.
Yeah, I mean, everything was the music. Growing up on novelas, the drama of it all. I was, you know, I'm the oldest of three sisters, but I was the most sentimental crybaby. I grew up on oldies. I think any LA girl has a strong relationship with KRS-101.
Of course.
And so I grew up listening to, like, oldies. Like, I got a boombox, I think, like, my 10th birthday. And so I would just be listening to music in my room, writing in my journal, reading whatever I was reading. Well, it wasn't even my room. It was the bottom bunk bed that you put the curtain around.
That is your space. It's your space. There you go. Yeah.
And my sisters were out playing, and I was in my room having all these existential crises as a pubescent girl.
Let me ask you, were you into hip hop?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What were your hip hop influences, if you have any, or were you listening to? Yeah.
So when I was younger, I went through many phases. I went through a Rough Riders phase. I don't know what was happening. I mean, DMX, right? But like, I had every single Eve, like her early stuff. But I also, you know, I'm from LA, so I grew up listening to a lot of, like, NWA, like the stuff that my older cousins listened to, you know, Sugar Free.
Shout out DJ Quick too.
Yeah. DJ Quick. Any of those sounds would immediately make me feel home.
That's right. And then
I went through, like, my snobby period where I was, like, a backpacker, supposedly. And so I was listening to, like, A Tribe Called Quest and
Jurassic
Common
Five,
Sense and, you know.
Yeah.
And then folks. Oh, I never really even talk about my hip hop much, like, in what I grew up with.
So,
you know?
I want to hear it. Yeah.
And then, yeah. And so hip hop and R&B have always been a big part of my music taste.
That's pretty cool. And that, in my research, and I don't know if this is accurate, you sort of started at least putting your work out there real publicly on a large scale on hiphoppoetry.com. Is that correct?
Yes. I try to be a rapper, y'all.
Yes. That's what I like to hear. Okay, good.
Didn't work out. I'm not a good rhymer. My rhymes are very obvious. It takes patience, and I'm not a patient person in that sense. But my rapping name was Misconceptions.
Hey,
never know.
You want to know what mine was? So Evan, it was Evolution. So not much better. Not much better. So there you go.
But I thought I was cooking with that, and then I wrote a couple of rap verses that were not. Just were not it. And I never recorded, never like said it. Okay. I was just writing it. And then
I'd love to hear hip-hop, the lost tapes if you did though. Yeah.
Oh goodness, I hope they're gone with the site. But that site has a lot of history for me. But hiphoppoetry.com was a forum online that was for poetry and hip hop.
Yeah.
And so there was like the hip hop section and the poetry section, and I spent a lot of years on there. It taught me a lot of things about myself and about my work, and a lot of hard lessons too.
Now, how do you feel? Let me actually go back. How did you feel when you initially, as a younger person, were putting yourself out there, even just on the web and all that kind of stuff on the site, vulnerable, et cetera? Like, what was that like?
It was vulnerable, but it was also, if I'm being honest, I was catfishing when I first went on there. Because I just thought that nobody wanted to hear poems from a fat, weird girl. Because at the time, that's who I was. I was the girl in our neighborhood that would walk around reading, and the boys would try to trip. Like, I was straight. And then when I was like 13, I announced that I wanted to be a nun. It didn't happen. But I was still smoking weed with the boys. It was just a very complicated, I was a complicated teenager with like a lot of different identities that I was trying to reconcile. So when I got online, I always felt like very unseen, undesired. Yeah. And I had been on party lines.
Oh, catfishing. Wow.
A very LA. I mean, I think it happens all over, but in LA, I think we really love the party lines.
Of course.
Yeah. And then when we got a computer at home, it opened up a whole other world. And, and I was catfishing on hiphoppoetry.com. And then for a few years, and I was part of the community, and I didn't expect that to happen. I didn't expect for my work. I didn't know what I was looking for.
Yeah.
So my work resonated with a lot of folks. I built a small readership there. And then somebody found my real MySpace. Oh, and wow. So then I confessed to the whole site. And there were a lot of other dumb things that I was doing. I didn't know better.
They were young.
You know, I plagiarized some song because I was just like, I really wish I wrote this song, so I translated it to English and I took credit for it. I dropped out of high school, so I didn't understand that plagiarizing is like the most unforgivable thing anybody could ever do.
And look, in a sense, imitation is a sincere form of flattery. So,
I learned that lesson hard. I got banned.
Oh, shit.
I got banned and I was gone for a while, and then I came back. I was allowed back, and the founder of the site, where he goes by Words, he's in New York. And he was just like, Jessica, you need to go share your poetry at open mics. Because a lot of those folks were at the Nuyorican in New York or Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. And he's like, you have a legendary venue in your city that you don't go to. And it's the Poetry Lounge. And so eventually, and then he goes, if you don't go to the Poetry Lounge, I'm going to ban you again. And so I went. And the first day I went was a reunion for Deaf Poetry Jam. Because a lot of the Deaf Poetry Jam poets came from LA.
Yeah.
They were from the Poetry Lounge and they were having a reunion. So I got to see Shihan Van Cleef, Maya del Valle, Bosia, Georgia Me, Poetry. Like a lot of them were there performing. And I went that first Tuesday and I never stopped going. And now all those folks are my friends now. And, I mean, you know, and some of them my mentors. And so that kind of, people are like, you talk about like your catfishing and that time, like so proudly. I'm like, yeah, because that gave way to me finding my home venue that I consider my college years, where it's where I learned everything about being a professional poet, everything about performance. I started competing in slams and I was coached by Shehan Van Cleef and Javon Johnson, who are my brothers now.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then a few years. So by the when I started going to the Poetry Lounge, it was 2008. And I didn't know what I was doing for a long time.
Right.
It took me a while to figure things out. And then around 2015, I had a poem go viral.
What was it? Which one?
It was my poem, How Not to Make Love to a Fat Girl. And it was a funny poem that I wrote after a Tinder date. And of a guy trying to rub, it was like a whole story. But the thing is about him rubbing my belly, trying to like make me feel comfortable. And I was just like, I'm not a genie lamp, bro. You know? And so the poem talks about that, like, don't do that. Yeah. And then like, but about like how everybody has their own insecurities, but being a large woman in a larger body, you navigate like either people fetishizing you or people, like using your weight against you. And so that poem went viral in 2015 when going viral actually did something for
was
you.
Was real, yeah.
I mean, like, not that anybody that goes viral now doesn't gain from it, but it used to be, like, life-changing back then.
It resonated more, had a longer lifespan. Yeah, for sure, right.
Yes, and so that's how my Instagram following started growing. So I had already been in the game forever. I didn't start. And then so then 2015, 2006, and then this whole time, I've been working service jobs. I was a cashier.
Yeah.
In a parking garage in Westwood Village.
Okay.
For a medical building where I used to give paparazzi tips when celebrities were in the building and they would kick me down a little bit of money.
Really? A little side hustle. Let's go.
And then I got transferred to Santa Monica after a while. Yeah. And then I was working out there. And, you know, celebrities are everywhere, but I didn't have any paparazzi connections there. And then, you know, folks working there, and I ended up getting fired from there in 2014. And I thought that I was going to go full time into poetry, but I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And then I started working at CVS.
No.
A very particular CVS, the one on La Cienega and Beverly, that's not going to be there soon.
Right. Wait, really?
I didn't know. The Kaiser bought the Cedar Sinai.
Cedar Sinai bought everything. Yeah.
They bought the Beverly Connection.
Wow. Interesting. Mm-hmm. You were giving out those long receipts, which are now.
I worked. And that CVS is wild because it's across the street from the Beverly Center and from the, what's that hotel?
The SLS?
The Sofitel?
Is it?
It's a Sofitel.
Okay.
And it's where the studios put up their celebrity guests. Mm. So they would come into the store all the time. So I got to see all kinds of folks there that would like, but it's, and I mention all of these things because it's so LA to be so casual around a lot of these folks. And then I remember that just being a cashier at a register and like talking to folks and being, and then folks started recognizing me at work from different things.
Yeah.
And eventually I quit CVS 10 years ago.
And then to become full time.
To become a full time artist.
Now, when did you know that this was a real path for you?
So I saw once I went to the Poetry Lounge, I realized that you could have a poetry career that wasn't necessarily having a book. Because the from being the young girl dreaming of writing a book to actually getting there, that path is feels like universes away from each other, right? Of course. And so, but I saw folks doing like the college circuits, right? Like the getting booked to go speak at different universities and colleges, and the venues, the poetry venues, traveling through the country. Some folks, you know, drive around and couch surf to do poetry stuff. So I saw all of those things. Although couch surfing was never for me. I'm not sleeping on people's couches. But I like my privacy and I like my comfort, but I started seeing folks that were doing it on a larger scale. And my mentor, Shehan Van Cleef, was one of the folks that pioneered a lot of that. He was the first person to have like a, I think he had a record deal for an album, a poetry album that came out. He was also working with the Poetry Jam with helping cast.
So,
and then I think he got a deal. I think he had a deal with Nike maybe.
Wow.
Or something. So he was a poet that had these big contracts really early
on. So you saw that it's at least out there and it's a possibility.
So then that was like, but I felt that I was it's hard to believe, but in around that time when I first came to the Poetry Lounge, I was very quiet, very timid. I used to think I was introverted. I'm fucking not. But it was just, I thought I was behaving the way that I thought somebody in my body should behave in spaces like that. You know, like I can't take up too much space because like, you know, I'm already not cool. I'm already not this. I think growing up in Hollywood adjacent kind of brings that into you where you're like, oh, I don't look like what the famous people look like, right? I don't look like what the successful people look like. And so when things started happening for me, I think it was a surprise for everybody, but also for me, where I'm just like, sometimes I still can't believe that this is what my life is, my like that I have a full career doing exactly what I dreamed of as a little girl. I mean, not exactly like this, who social media didn't exist.
Well, yeah.
I'm aging myself, but social media didn't exist and virality wasn't a thing. But the fact that like I get to share my work with folks and my story with folks and on a daily thing. So, but around 2016, when I was at CVS, I was starting to, I took an interview with Latina Magazine.
Yeah.
Right before my shift, and I was in the back of the store on the phone talking to the reporter, the journalist. And I remember my manager came, one of my managers, and he's like, can you clock in? And I was just like, bro, no, I'm not clocking in. I'm on the phone. And then being at the register, like when the article went live and like looking at like sharing it on my Instagram and seeing the comments coming in, like under the register, like I remember all of that. Like, I mean, it was just 10 years ago. It was so vivid. But then, I was started turning down speaking gigs because I was afraid that I was going to get in trouble at work for like taking so many days off.
Okay.
And so then 1 month I was named employee of the month. And then I was just like, all right, I'm going to go out on this note. And I think I was employee of the month 2 months in a row. And then I gave my resignation because I was just like, I'm not going to fucking work here on Halloween.
Good job.
So my last day was October 27 because I was not going to be there during the whole West Hollywood.
Gosh. That's so
incredible. Because it would just get nuts. That story would get nuts. Like there was once a naked person in the bathroom and somebody
I'm sure
came
it wasn't
in.
Just once.
I mean, but no, but this one time. And then like, Jessica, somebody's naked in the bathroom. And I go to the bathroom. I open the door and I go, ma'am, you're naked. She goes, no, I'm not. I close the door. I'm like, what do I know?
What the?
So there was a lot of that stuff that would happen, especially on the weekends. And they were really good to me. It's a 24-hour store, and they let me work. The manager, Brandon, would let me work from 7 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Okay.
Monday through Friday. Yeah. Who gets a schedule like that working a service job? But I was really good at running the front of the store.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
But so when he tried to talk me out of quitting a lot, but I knew it was time.
You had to chase the dreams and the passion. Yeah.
So I left CBS the next year. I got offered my first book deal, and then I had
just like books. That. How did that come about?
Well, because I had been doing all of this even while working.
But they came.
So Not a Cult at the time that my publisher was just starting, and they had published a few of my friends.
Yeah.
And they had invited me to their events to perform, and they saw that when they would book me, the room would get full.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had my poetry collective Chingona Fire with Angela Aguirre, another LA legend. And she and I were really close, and we had always we're like, where are all the girls at? Where are the Latinas at? You know, and we started the poetry. We started our collective because we just wanted to do more gigs together.
Yeah.
And then we hosted a poetry night where we invited a few other, Mayra del Valle, Carla Cordero, Rachel McKibbins, the other poets that came up through slam and spoken word like we did. And we were somewhere in Highland Park or Pasadena, and the room was at capacity. It was wild. And our mentor, Shihan, came up to us afterwards. He goes, you have to do this every month. And I was like, no. And I was already touring. I was doing these college gigs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was gone like maybe 3 or 4 days a week on the road. And then I would come back home and that's what my schedule was. And I'm like, I don't want to fucking do this.
Right,
like, I don't.
Right. It's work.
But
man.
We saw the necessity for it. And Angela had a full-time job. She worked, as a educator, and we made it work for, I think, we were actively hosting events for 2 years. And, open mics. We were hopping around mostly in the Boyle Heights, Highland Park area, looking for the community we wanted to connect with. And, our last home where we were for the last year was Avenue 50 in their old location because they moved now.
Yeah.
Avenue 50 in Highland Park. And it was just super cool. And it was packed out I used to tell, jokingly would tell my homeboys, I'm like, if you want to meet a badass woman, just go to one of my events. They're all there. And, but Chingona Fire was really great. And so we, by 2018, everything was just so busy for me that we just kind of put that on pause and never unpaused it again. But it was a really beautiful period of my career. And so, yeah.
And sometimes things like that, I don't want to say expiration date because that sounds like it's finite and forced, mm-hmm. but the magic can only be magic for so long, you know, so when you're, whatever happens through cosmic and the stars and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you move on and you're onto, you know, bigger and better things. I do want to pause. I got to take a sponsor break. We are Have you ever tried Copico, by the way?
Yes.
You have?
They're very loved in my house.
They are. Okay. So Copico, these are awesome. I always tell you guys, I take them while I'm driving all around the city. If I get drowsy, pop a Copico. Two of these equals one cup of coffee.
Wow.
And for me, one of them does the trick, just for the record. So they're local liquor stores, some 7-Elevens. I don't know if they're at CVS's. I know they weren't back then. But mm-mm. they're delicious, they're good, and they actually work. So shout out Copico. One thing I want to talk to you about, and this is important, and I can't believe I didn't mention it. We're this far into the show.
My mom loves them. But now that just explained a lot to me, because that lady's always like, and so because she used to take the bus to Palisades. Oh, she worked in Palisades track. for a long time. And so she would have them in her purse and pop them in when she would say, when my mouth gets sour.
Tell you what, my wife discovered them. And one day I come home, she's like, I had five today. She's like, I love them. She's like, why'd you give me these coffee? I can't. They're delicious, but they're good. But let's talk about your Salvadoran.
Yes.
And that's incredibly important. I want to read something. One of your poems in this book, in Corazon, in fact, A Salvadoran Heart. You start with this. I come from women of corn and cotton fields, of machete and fire, of water and stone. I'm the daughter of a river and mango tree. My tongue came to me through the jacote seed. My heart belonged to the ocean before it found my body. Mm-hmm. And that's how you start A Salvadoran Heart. Mm-hmm. Tell me all that, what that means to you, what being Salvadoran in Los Angeles specifically means to you. And growing up, did you recognize the significance of that culture? Because it is such a proud and widespread mm-hmm. culture in this city that I feel as kind of an outsider to that culture is only now really starting to get that recognition for the impact and importance in Los Angeles.
Yeah. So my parents are refugees. They came here during the Civil War in El Salvador. They met here. They didn't meet. They met in Boyle Heights. So I was born and raised in Silver Lake, but I always tell people that I was conceived in Boyle Heights.
Okay.
So it's part of my origin story.
Yeah.
But they met here and so I grew up surrounded by Salvadorans. We lived on Vendome and Sunset.
Wow, right there.
Across from Los Globos. And that whole building, it's a brick building that now I think it's been repurposed. And I think it's a facility for folks that need to get their bearings or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But my whole family had taken over most of the building. And so it was we were running in and out of each other's apartments, and in the back there was undeveloped land. Who hears of that now?
I was thinking over there. No,
there's a building built there now, but it was
some developer was licking his chops. Yeah, go on.
It was like a dirt hill that we would the kids would slide down, would have old kiddie pools and slide down. And so all I knew was Salvadorans because it was everybody around me was Salvadoran.
Right.
People from my mother's village. They're not my relatives, but might as well be. And that's all we knew. And then I started, I went to elementary school and my cousins were still, I went to Mitchell Torena Elementary and, all of my cousins were there. And so I was still immersed by all of that. And once I got to high school, in the 90s, dating myself, but, you know, in, I got to high school and then I realized that like xenophobia and a lot of like other Latinos being pitted against each other and how prevalent Mexican culture really was, right? And there was a lot of Mexican culture around us.
Right.
I have my aunt married a Mexican, and so he was othered because he was the exception in our family.
Wow.
So to me, he was like the Mexican, you know? So, but I grew up with a lot of things like coming into my culture that I thought were Salvadoran, but were from Mexican culture just because of LA, right?
Wow. That's an interesting dynamic right there. Yeah.
Yes. And also in El Salvador, my mother was a housekeeper for a family in El Salvador, a Mexican family. So a lot of our home cooked meals are not Salvadoran. They have a lot of Mexican influence.
Wow.
So once I got to middle school and high school, and I just have a vivid memory of when boys would realize I was Salvadoran.
Yeah.
They would immediately use like the slur words for us, right? Which I'm not going to repeat because they're annoying. Yeah. But so I remember thinking, I was like, I was so hard at, like, I wanted to be Chicana so bad because that's what you're taught in, you're taught that history in school. So I thought that, you know, and then you see, the Mexican American, actors and comedians, you know, like I was older when George Lopez came out, but you just didn't get to see Salvadorans in the spotlight or anybody Central American really. Or if they were, you wouldn't know because they didn't lead with that. Right.
Right.
And, you know, I remember taking Chicano studies and wanting so bad to be able to identify with that. And, a lot of what the representation of Salvadoran culture has been is newer. And I think, you know, not to put on a bigger hat than I deserve, but I feel like I've been part of that.
No, you absolutely deserve it.
Because I was in a lot of spaces that were very Chicano forward, and I would have to correct folks and be like, with all due respect, I'm not Chicana. I have a lot of love and respect for the community. And a lot of the support I've gotten in my career has been because of Chicanx places, but it's just not my identity. And I think that that's something that I started pushing back and sitting more in that, I think, in my early 20s.
Yeah.
In my 20s, where I realized that. But I grew up going to Salvador my whole life. So I have like a deep relationship with my parents' home country.
Really? Like how?
Every
like,
summer they'd put me on a plane and I'd be sent off to a
Salvador. Wait, by yourself?
Yes. The first time.
Oh, wow.
The first time I went alone, I was 12.
Okay.
And I had never met my grandmother.
Damn. Okay.
I never met my grandmother in person or my cousins and aunts and uncles that live there. And, you know, my mom thought it was better to have me go over there than to have to worry about me running around here in Silver Lake.
Would you spend the summer there? So you were.
Yes.
Whoa. Yes. Okay.
Because.
So you really get it. Okay.
You know, Silver Lake when I was growing up, it's not the Silver Lake now.
I'm going to get into that part.
We're going to talk about that.
Section. But, yeah, for sure.
But she didn't want me running around, you know, because I had a crush on all the graffiti artists, and she was just like, you're going to get out of here. And so, but going back home, I went home when I was 12, when I was 13. 14, and then I didn't when I was 15, and then 16, 18, and then again, like in my early 20s. And I went back in 2023, and I was on a national tour in El Salvador.
Yeah.
I got to tour the
country.
That's
badass.
It was super cool.
Wow. What was it like? What did you learn being in El Salvador?
Very complex.
Yeah.
Very complex, and everything in El Salvador is politicized because, you know, the civil war is still very prevalent everywhere. And then also, in my opinion, right now, they're going through a fascist government.
Wow.
And so,
that's Bukele.
Bukele.
Yeah.
But then you also have to be cautious of how you move because of that. In transparency, I was a guest of the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador.
Yeah.
You know, this was during Biden's presidency, just need to make that clear. But it was also really jarring to see how much of the U.S. Hand is involved everywhere, because I was being taken place to places owned by the United States at the time.
No kidding.
So like universities, campuses, and it was just really interesting in that sense, but the people are beautiful.
Yeah, of course.
And I went, I think, I got humbled because I went in thinking, like, I'm bringing poetry to my people, because the way the events were set up was that we would open up with me performing.
Yeah.
And then we would have a mini workshop within the event where there was a poem that I read in my performance and we were inviting people to write their version of that poem.
Yeah.
Which is my love letter to, it's a love letter I have to Los Angeles called What I Know.
Yeah.
And so then we would ask them to write about what do they know about their community, their country, their loved ones. And they would write, we would give them 20 minutes, 15 minutes to write. And then we would have an open mic where they were able to come and sit next to me on stage.
Yeah.
And read poems. And in those moments, so many beautiful things were shared and so much, people push back so much on like the status quo there. You know, we had queerness isn't accepted there. You know, and so we had young folks read poems about their queerness. We had a man that had just come out of prison and read a poem about wanting to reconnect, like hoping that his sons give him space to reconnect with them. We had, these two sisters that came to an event and they were elderly women. And they're Afro-Salvadorans.
Yeah.
And they read about that. And they were like, we have African ancestry. Don't let people tell you otherwise that El Salvador does not have Afro-Indigenous folks.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, it gave way for a lot of that. And sure, like I came in under the banner of the United States. That's very complex, right? Like
right.
When you think of imperialism and all of that. But I think it was really subversive where we took that and we allowed folks to have room to speak. One of the places, and I'll end with this, one of the places that I was taking was in Santa Ana, a library that had been defunded by the current government.
Right.
And it was a library that was over 100 years old. And the local people saved it. The local people, like, were able That's to awesome. Save it and have it. And but they went from having over 1,000 books to maybe having a space as big as this office full of books. The building is there, but that's the amount of books that they have. And they were really excited to show me their, like, computer lab room. And it was just three PCs, you know, that older models than what we're used to. But but it just taught me that I wasn't there to introduce poetry to anybody.
Yeah,
I was there to learn that poetry and learn that connection. And they also, I also had, like, a weekend full of where I got to give writing workshops to other folks that are educators. So they went on to teach writing workshops themselves to other folks. And it was just really, really beautiful. But I really got to see the country because when I went back as a young girl, I would only go to my mom's village. Right. So I was just there. Right. I wasn't there as a tourist.
Yeah.
I was there to be with my grandma and my cousins.
To live. Yeah.
And cry over the fact that they killed my favorite chicken, and made her soup and they didn't tell me. Or, you know, things like that. Or my grandma would tell me not to get too attached to the pigs. But to answer the question of the poem that you said of like, that I come from women of water and stone.
Yeah.
Of sugar canes. It's what my family is. You know, I just recently learned that my maternal grandparents, both of them did not know how to read or write.
Wow.
But I was raised on stories.
Yeah.
I was raised on their stories and my mother's stories, who my mother only has a third grade education. And my father has some college education, had some college education, but my mother's family didn't have a lot of that. But, you know, what we put value for in this country is really different. What we put value on in this country is really different than what they do there. Cause it doesn't make your stories any more or less valuable.
No.
If you're not writing them down. And I still think it's cool that that's who I come from. And then I make a living out of reading and writing now.
Did you feel pressure when you went down to El Salvador?
In a way, because you see so much necessity.
Yeah.
That you want to fix everything, right? Yeah. And I remember as a young girl, I used to be like, I have to make it. I have to, so that I could, like, I think it's still one of my dreams is to, like, be able to fund a school. Or some kind of center there. We have a home. My mother inherited my grandmother's home and I will be inheriting that home.
Yeah.
And so I told my mom, I'm like, well, after like all of your siblings and everybody like that lives there isn't around anymore, what if I turn it into a school? My mom wasn't thrilled about it. But you know, if she's not around, my mother we live together. I love my mother. I'm going to give that disclaimer before somebody tells her that, like, but like, that's my dream is to have a space in El Salvador where like folks can just I would love to have a not necessarily a school, but, somewhere that encourages writing and reading within my mother's village, which up until very recently was not incorporated to any town. So it was kind of like on its own.
What's the village called, by the way?
It's called, it's had its different names, but it's Cantón El Cobanal, and it belongs to San Rafael Obrajuelo. Now it's been taken into that municipality. I can never pronounce that word, but into there. And, but that's my home. That's my home and I learned that, historically the folks there have grew indigo. And so I've been researching that, and we'll see how that shows up in my work later. But the mangoes and my, that I write a lot in on the cover of my book,
yeah,
it signifies my grandmother's, our home, our property there, because it ends at a creek. And then that at the end of that property, there's a bunch of mango trees.
Yeah.
And so growing up, I lived off of those mango trees. Like, we would eat them, but to get to the trees, we have to go through the field where we kept the cattle.
Yeah.
So it was an adventure because I was afraid of the cows.
But you ended up getting to those mangoes. Yeah, and by the way, just for the record, and mom, a school would be such a fantastic legacy.
Yeah. I mean,
honestly, that's a really special kind of goal. I want to talk to something, that you speak of a lot is, being proud of your identity, but mostly in your body. Right? You have a quote. There's many quotes, but one is, I mean, how many young black fat girls look up to Lizzo and dream big? And how many brown girls look up to me and feel the same way? Right? And in this culture, in America specifically, you know, you're fighting against the status quo, but you've been so open and proud of who you are. And that's so important, especially now in this day and age. Speak on that for a while.
Yeah. So like even particularly that Lizzo quote, I don't even know where you found that. I think that must have been like a tweet or a
interview. I want to say it was either with La Piscucha magazine or Pop Sugar. One of the two.
Well, somewhere. Kay. But I got to see Lizzo in concert right before she made it big time, right? Like, yeah, she was still at the Palladium. But I just remember being there and feeling so proud of her.
Yeah.
And so proud of like what she was doing, especially because most of her dancers were also in large bodies. And, you know, and it was the first time that we've seen a pop star that looks like Lizzo. And so, and really, and that watching like her shows and her social media, how black women would come out and feel so seen,
yeah,
by her and supported by her and other women too, not specifically black women, like so many of us, right?
Right.
But I think it just speaks something specific when culturally you could connect with the person that you're seeing too. And I think that, as Latinas, our bodies are fetishized so much in the curvy, like Salma Hayek, Sofia Vergara kind of style. And so to have me kind of, I've been in rooms with some of these folks and I'm like, well, it's you and me, girl. So either they feel themselves in you or they see themselves in me. But, right, but there's so many women that just don't fit,
yeah,
that standard of beauty and they want to see themselves somewhere else. And,
yeah,
and I'm not, I don't think I'm representative of everybody and I can't ever be, but I think a lot of what my work was, especially like early on when I was first, using social media as a big part of my activism with body liberation,
yeah,
was that folks just were not used to seeing Latinas in that space.
Right.
They were seeing, you know, the body liberation movement was started by black women and then white women co-opted it. And then it became kind of that for a while. And so, you know, by taking note from the black women that were doing really beautiful things, I try to just find a way to take that with giving them still respect and then just allowing Latinas to see themselves in different ways. So I had a movement, a hashtag, back when hashtags mattered.
Shit. Oh my Jeez, God. Right.
A long time ago, but 10 years ago, but it was panzas chingonas, which is badass bellies. And I would invite women to send me pictures of them in crop tops because back then I would only perform in crop tops and it was a stance that I took.
Wow.
And so everything was like sheer crop top. Whatever. My mom used to be like, why are you paid $40 for this shirt? And it's like, it's a doily. And I was just like, it's fashion, mom. But, or she'd be like, where's the rest of your shirt? But I think that sometimes even if folks don't see themselves in you, they just need the permission to figure out what you're doing in their way. Just like Lizzo gave so many of us permission to figure it out in our own way. And there's many women before Lizzo, right? Yeah. That were doing that also, whose names I'm blanking on right now, but they existed. When I was a teenager, I would look at Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's who I had.
Okay.
I had Monique, Rosie O'Donnell, and Miss Piggy.
Damn. Okay.
You know, right, and right. So we've come a long way now that there's now like a list of different bodies that people could see themselves in and
damn right.
different sizes, you know, especially in this land of Ozempic.
Oh my God.
And so I have a new poetry collection that will be coming forth in the next year or two. It just found its publisher. I can't say yet. But it found its publisher. And so, it'll be good coming job, out, but yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's called Mentirosa and it talks a lot about, my journey, moving through what led me to catfishing and after and kind of celebrating this fat body that I'm in because it's the only body I have, you know, but I think women, we get, I think marginalized identities, not just women. You know, if you're not a cis man, your bodies are so scrutinized. So much and media gets so loud and now social media, right? But social media allowed us to kind of diversify that, right? Because I remember Tumblr. Yeah. For me it was Tumblr where.
Ooh.
So in 2012.
Ooh. Yeah.
13 was when I was just like, I'm never going to catfish again.
Okay.
Right? I was catfishing on hip hop poetry. I left and then I started catfishing somewhere else.
Okay.
But then I just wasn't involving my poetry in it. And then around that time, I had like around 2012, 2013, I had this epiphany that just kind of came. I was involved with some guy.
Yeah.
I was catfishing him, but we really liked each other. And he just really wanted to like video because I couldn't run away. Look, I don't know how people do it now, but back then we didn't have the forward facing cameras. The laptops didn't come with computers. So I had all the excuses, but then technology caught up with me.
Yeah.
And I didn't have them anymore. So I was just like, hey, so I got to tell you something. I'm not the girl in the pictures.
Yeah.
And we had this whole, we were crying. We've remained friends. We're friends to this day. He just recently had a baby and I'm so happy for him. His partner had a baby. They had a baby together and I'm so happy for them. But that was like the big moment for me where I was just like, I need to figure some shit out. I took my ass to therapy. I figured stuff out. But, when I was just like, I have to learn how to not hate myself.
Right. Right.
And so then I went on Tumblr and I was purposely looking for other large people to see. And like when I found people like Tess Holliday, you know, and so many other, people that were modeling or just sharing their outfits of the day or all these different things on there. Then I was just like, oh, then why not me too?
Yes.
And so then I started doing that. And then fast forward all these years, now I'm a voice in that.
Damn right.
And it's, which is weird. I'm like, all I was doing was just posting my belly all over the place, but, and then I got a little out of control for a while, but. Because then it got a little bit more scandalous, but then I reeled it back in.
Yeah, but you deserve making up for lost time. Come on.
Look, but it's been a whirlwind and it's really beautiful to hear so many stories of so many other folks that felt encouraged by the many of us, right? Because it's not just me, the many of us, and now there's more and more. And like when I get scared or I start getting frustrated about how thinness is back in.
Hmm.
Not that it's wrong to be thin. I'm going to say that ahead of time before folks start thinking that I'm condemning thinness, but.
And she will be up in the comments. So watch it. Yeah. Right.
I am a keyboard warrior.
Right. So.
And I've been, when you've been on the receiving end of a lot of trolls, you could keep up with them.
I was going to say, then, it makes you tough, makes you strong.
Oh, they can keep up with me. They can't. I will roast you all day. And that's not a challenge. That's not, please don't.
She only has so much time. Yeah.
Only so much time. You got to be worthy, you know. But it's like, it's really like it, the fact that it's being pushed upon people now, right? And folks are think that it's okay to body shame and all those things. It just reminds me that the work doesn't end. And I have a 15-year-old niece and, another toddler niece that need a world that where their bodies are not going to be policed in whatever shape they come in.
And to think beautiful is to be beautiful.
Yeah, to be beautiful.
You know, that's that the confidence is who you are. When you present that, people read that and then it becomes okay. You know, it's kind of interesting how that works. But no, you've been a great advocate and person in that regard. I want to talk about Los Angeles, of course. That's right here. And you are a very proud, I don't use this word, but Angeleno. For some reason, that word never sat right with me, but it is what it is. But Los Angeles native, daughter of immigrants. What does this city mean to you?
It's my love, like my biggest love story.
Yeah.
And it sounds corny because you're like, Jessica, how can you love a whole city? No, I do. I do. I've taken the metro. I used to take the metro from the breath of Silver Lake to Santa Monica daily.
Yeah.
I got to see the span of, you get to really see a city if you take its public transportation.
Yes.
And I just love this city. It's, you know, it's portrayed in certain ways and you get to see like the Hollywood aspect. It depends where you're seeing it through, right? You either, hear about the homelessness crisis, which is very real. Or you hear about Hollywood, or you hear about like the land and the influencers now, right? And for me, yes, those all exist, but there's so much other LA too. There is so much other LA. So beautiful. And like the people of the city are welcoming, loving, generous, fly as fuck. Like, and different pockets of LA have different styles, right? Like, South Central, it has its own culture. And then you go to Boyle Heights and they have their own culture and their own culture, like, artistic styles and hubs and even music. And it's so dope that the city is so big that when I travel to other cities, I could tell you what neighborhood of LA it feels like.
Yes.
You know, I could be in San Antonio and I'd be like, oh, I feel like I'm in East LA. Right? Like, we were in Tucson. Yeah, we were in Tucson and I was just like, this feels like a little suburbs, a little artsy. I was just like, I would give it maybe like a Pasadena, maybe a Glendale if I'm being generous.
Yeah.
You know, and like, see, everything, you know, in Pasadena, England, not LA, but you know what I mean. And then like,
I mean, like greater LA is LA.
Greater LA is LA. Yeah. But like, everything feels, you know, the Bay feels like, you know, Inglewood, South Central, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I know people from the Bay are going to get really mad because I hate being compared to LA, but I love you, Bay. But I would say if I ever leave LA, I'll go live in Oakland.
Really?
I used to say that.
Okay.
I don't know. Now I haven't been in Oakland since pre-pandemic, so I can't say that as strongly as I used to. But I mean, I wouldn't leave California.
But 500 plus neighborhoods in LA, and this is something I learned doing LA in a minute and exploring, is, you know, I knew different neighborhoods. Luckily, my parents always took me around. You know, my dad was a box manager, so we were in South LA. My mom was a hippie. She always take me to Venice Boardwalk and, you know, to Griffith Park. So luckily, as a kid, I got like good exposure. But really, like, doing, and look, I'm a car guy, so I'm always in my car, which is different than the public transit, but you're still seeing the city and you get out and walk around to really feel a neighborhood. And it's like you said, every single neighborhood has its personality.
Absolutely.
Its quirks, its food, its culture, and they're all so unique and in love. I mean, and even this map, you know, this is just like the little, like, but every single one of those has that identity. You know, and it's funny because like Porter Ranch, like who goes to Porter Ranch? By the way, it's where I met my wife, but that's a whole different story. But like it even has like its own culture. Sylmar, of course, all these different places have the different culture. And that's like the beauty of LA. But let's talk about yours growing up in Silver Lake. Difference between now and tell me about the evolution that you've seen and what you think about that.
I think it's funny. Every time I'm dating somebody and I bring them to Silver Lake, it just becomes kind of like, I become an LA in a minute. Where I'm just like, here's this building and this is what it was before it became this, you know? And and so, but for me, it really is that it's a lot of like, keeping the history of what every building was beforehand and telling folks like, you know, there's, I like, you know, the corner of where the Cafe Tropical is.
Yeah.
That has had many iterations. I love its iteration of it now, but I really miss the Donato iteration of it, which was maybe 10 years ago. And all of my books were written in that cafe. because it's in my neighborhood. So I just walk over.
So it's already been historic, but now you just added that extra stamp, right?
I did that intentionally. I intentionally have been very loud about my love for the Cafe Tropical because the more that the neighborhood becomes gentrified.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the story. There used to be a mural across the street from Cafe Tropical on what used to be, the Silver Sun Pharmacy, I think.
Okay.
And now it's a tanning place that I forgot the name of it.
Perfect.
Right. Sugar something. I don't know, but it's a tanning place now, which is really interesting because gentrification got rid of the brown people, but they're getting tanned, but whatever.
Now they're trying to be brown. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But there was a mural on there that was about Silver Lake artists, right? Huh. And so then they had the Silver Sun pickups. They had, is it Elliot Smith?
Beck, maybe, or no, Beck was like kind of part. But
they had all the artists on there, and it was all white dudes. And then I was just like, I want to be on that mural. And so when I started working on my books, I made it really loud. I made sure to be really loud about me working in the Cafe Tropical, talking about it in interviews. It's mentioned in the thank yous of all three of my books because I want folks. Here's the story. I was in San Antonio for the first time in 2016. It was the first time that I got booked to go perform a solo gig outside of California.
Wow. Okay.
And the people that brought me out knew me and they knew that I'm a big Sandra Cisneros fan. And so they drove me by a restaurant called Taco Haven.
Okay.
And they took me to her home that was out there and that when she used to live out there, that's like very known for being her home. She's not in there anymore. So we weren't invading her privacy or anything.
Okay.
But they took me to her home. I took a picture outside. Then we drove by Taco Haven and, my friend pointed out the restaurant, she's like, Sandra Cisneros would go in there when she was working on Woman Hollering Creek and she would sit at the same table. And I said, bet. And so that's what I did for Cafe Tropical. I'm like, anybody that reads my work is going to come through Silver Lake and point at the cafe and be like, that's where Jessica wrote her books. And as long as I'm in Silver Lake, that's every major meeting I've taken it in that cafe. I got interviewed by the LA Times there.
Dude.
I got interviewed by the New Yorker there.
Yeah.
I've had whenever anybody wants to take some kind of meeting, that's where I'm not going to take them to the house where my mom and my chihuahua and my niece and nephew are running around. So we meet at the coffee shop and it's become an extension of my home. And so whoever the owner, whenever has a new owner, I make sure that they know that like, hey, I work out of here. So you better like me. But the current owners are really, really great. And, you know, Danny is really wonderful. And so are the other two and Manny, one of the chefs, and they all know my nephew and he loves the croissants there. And, the community is really beautiful because they're all in the sober community. So it has like a really communal, beautiful feeling now.
Yeah, everybody trying to uplift it. I need a space like that now. Now you got me thinking, you know, what's my Cafe Tropical? Were you worried for real quick when it was going to shut down? Because I remember I did a story. I was like, Cafe Tropical is shutting down. But
so this is what happened. Yeah. I was on tour. I was in El Salvador.
Yeah.
And my phone had gotten stolen at LAX on my way there.
Come on.
So I had like a little whatever phone and I was only contacting my manager and my family when I was there. So I wasn't really talking to anybody. And then, once I was about to come back, so my tour ended and I spent 4 days with my family. I purposely planned it out where I would stay a little bit longer. And so, I really wasn't on social media because I was connecting with my relatives that I hadn't seen in a while. I hadn't been to Salvador in over a decade. And so I somehow went on one of my pages, because I was like logged out, you know, like
whatever. New phone.
Yeah,
yeah. Starting
somebody, somebody emailed me.
Yeah,
the LA Times emailed me asking for a quote, and that's how I found out the Cafe Tropical was closing, and I'm sobbing. Gonna come back the next day. I think I called my manager, and I was just like, "What is whatever." And then they were gonna have like the official closing day was going to be, I think, December 2nd. I came back on December 1st and I was just like, I have a day to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Mind you, this corner is where all of my life has happened.
Yeah.
All of my life. It's where the bus stop is. And so, you know, they like some of the folks that worked there had been working there through different owners. So they remembered my father who passed away 16 years ago. I forget how many, it's been so many years now, but there's men there that saw me grow up. that knew me as a girl. And then it's now, you know,
embedded in your identity.
And so I wanted to be able to say goodbye to them. And I came and I ran over that morning. I ran over and then I see that it's closed. And I'm fucking sobbing. And I had to go to get my phone. I had to get a replacement phone because I was back in town. So then I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. And a bunch of people were coming to try to open the door, like, you know, and just stood there in the corner for a little bit and cried with random people, with people I don't know. And then when I came back, I was like two blocks away and I saw people standing outside of the cafe. So I ran. I ran over and it was like some of the workers were there. And then I was able to communicate with Manny, who still works there now. And we had been in touch to fundraise for the employees that were left without any aid. And then I had been in touch and then he said, hey, there's someone interested in buying the cafe. And then once they had bought it, they invited me to come over and I met them. They had a different, like local folks, like Staples that had been coming over. They invited a few of us. And so we were able to go and meet them. And I was really excited to be able to share that it was going to reopen.
That's a badass.
And the guys are there, great now. And, I go hang out there and I get fed too much when I go. Cause like I'll buy my food and then they'll be like, you want to try this? And it's really cool. It's really great.
What's funny is I think it was Danny. Somebody there reached out and was like, you need to do a story on us. Cause I did a story on them closing.
Yes.
And they're like, you need to do a story on us, like reopening and being open and thriving and all this kind of stuff. Now I know that that's your like resident table and like one day going to have a little plaque on
we
it.
We joke. Like, where I'm like, I think I have to pay you guys rent. Cause on Fridays, they're open till 10 p.m., so I tend to get there, and I'll be there, like, and then, like, I'll take up a whole table, and I plan out my day where, like, I'll work during the morning, and then I have people kind of rotate in and out, like, it's my socializing day, so I'll just have friends come, have a coffee with me, they leave, somebody else will come, and then it'll be dinner time, and then we'll just go across the street to Silver Lake Ramen and have dinner.
Damn.
And then I walk home.
You got it good. So, okay. So outside of Silver Lake, tell me about if you have a day, a weekend in Los Angeles, outside of Silver Lake, where do you enjoy? What are the places that you like to be, to visit, to eat, whatever?
What I say like my home, I have multiple LA homes, right? So outside of LA, I think one of the biggest places that I connect with, and I've mentioned it a few times, is Boyle Heights.
Yeah.
Particularly Espacio. Espacio 1839? Yeah, 1839. And they're owned by Nico and Mayra, and they're a married couple that are wonderful, but it's a community space. It's a store.
Yeah.
And they also have, it's like a store with like shirts, accessories, things like that. But they also have like a bookstore within that store. And they also have a booth where it's available for anybody in the community that wants to record a podcast or a DJ set.
Badass.
I briefly had a podcast. I didn't know what I was doing, but I briefly had a podcast that I would go record there. And then I typically like have a lot of events in that space. I collaborate with them a lot and it's just really wonderful. It's just like right next to, it's right next to Mariachi Plaza.
All right.
That little radius right there is
across from the Boyle Hotel. What is that called? The build. Oh my God. Why am I drawing? Where La Monarca is.
Yes. So it's La Monarca. They're on the other side of it.
Okay.
So where Eastside Love is, Eastside Love and then Distrito 14, I think. Man. And then it's Espacio and they do beautiful things. They have like once a month, they have Caminarte, which is where they have vendors and they take up the whole street.
Yeah.
And it's a really beautiful space. And so much whenever I curate space events or have like community events, it's out of there so much that people think I'm from Boyle Heights. And I'm just like, I love it. But no, because I'm really big on like, don't claim what's not yours.
Yeah, of course. Come on.
But it's a big part of my journey and my story. And then, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with the West Side.
Oh, don't we all? At least speak for myself. Yes, absolutely.
I really miss Third Street Promenade. I really, really miss Third Street Promenade.
What are they going to do?
I used to wander when I was, before my career, before anything, when I felt I was invisible.
It was fucking awesome. That's what it was. Yeah, back in the day.
I would go to the food court. I would go to Barnes & Noble, buy a book.
Yeah.
And then I would go to the food court and read and just eat whatever the hell I was eating. And then I would go catch a movie at the AMC. And then I would get out like at 1 or 2 in the morning, like after work. I would just, that was my routine after work. And then I would get on the 4 and go back home. And then I would go sit, at Ocean Park a little bit to like be with the sea, with the ocean.
Yeah.
And then I would go back home. And I think it doesn't exist anymore, but that was like one of my favorite places in the whole world.
Damn, Santa Monica, please fix that. I know you're trying. They will have. I think the latest that I heard was they were going to make it alcohol friendly. Like, oh, you can have open containers and like drink. Yeah, and like,
that's scary.
I know. So I don't know what the real solution is. But
yeah, but what it was before was really beautiful with the street performers and just the chaos.
It was
of
fun.
It was
man.
So much fun.
I was a UCLA kid, so we'd go over there all the time. It was
It's so
awesome.
Easy. You get on the blue line and it takes you right over. And you know, I was in Westwood, so I would say I'm a UCLA kid. I didn't go to UCLA, but you know, I was by the UCLA Extension and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all, even the Westwood Village, I knew it like the back of my hand. And everything's so different. Post 2020, everything changed so much. But, and then another neighborhood, I have family in Highland Park. Okay. So I spent a lot of time in Highland Park.
Another area that's changed dramatically. Yes. Yeah.
But my cousin owns a little corner home there that like is really beautiful, and we used to have our Chingona fire right down the street on Avenue 50 something. My cousin lives near Avenue 52, so like that whole area. And what other neighborhood pockets that like have been really? I mean, all of them. It's just you find somewhere, you know, Koreatown. It's great. Dude. The Line used to be the hotel that I would go run away to.
Yeah.
I would book a room on, when I was touring a lot, so I had the money to do it, I would book a room on the high floor overlooking Griffith Park.
Oh, shit.
And I would go book it for like 3-4 nights and I would be writing there and then would go down to the lobby. And, you know, and then later on, I wish I knew of BCD Tofu House back then, but BCD Tofu House, I'm really obsessed with it. And my friends always tell me that I have to stop going as much because I'm going to burn it. But I dream of BCD Tofu House all the time.
Wow. No, it's a good, again, legendary LA spot. And you really are inspired by LA and you really are of LA. And I want to close out because we could talk. Both of us are talkers. So I know we could talk forever. But
And shout out to the Salvadoran Corridor and MacArthur Park.
Oh, my
Park.
God. Yes.
I grew up having to go with my mom to buy stuff for tamales and pupusas and all that there. And I got a fake ID when I was 20.
I got my ID on Alvarado when I was, I think, 19. But yeah, that was mine.
Yeah.
Okay. One last thing. You have a great freaking quote. Especially as somebody, a high school dropout, but that's not even relevant because of the success that you've had and everything you've accomplished. Right?
I like to say that though, for people to know that it's not one linear way to get to where you go to.
Again, it's the motivation and the intellect and just what's in your heart and your soul. Mm-hmm. There's a quote that you had that it really resonated with me too. Failure sucks, right? And it hurts and it's a heartbreak. But success is a different kind of heartbreak that nobody tells you about.
Mm-mm.
Tell me about it. Tell us about that.
James Baldwin once said that success, more like the spotlight, is the enemy of writers. Because the whole thing is that we're not supposed to know anything. How James Baldwin said is that we're supposed to approach the typewriter, right? In his time, it was the typewriter. For me, it's the keyboard. Right. That we're supposed to approach the page in a state of unknowing, in a state of hoping to figure it out by the time you're done.
Yeah.
And fame kind of robs you of that a little bit because you're expected to have the answers.
Right.
You're expected to not make mistakes. And becoming a public figure means you make your mistakes in public. And you're afforded less grace, and that's painful sometimes, you know? Like, I've had different circumstances in my careers where people have been disappointed or frustrated or whatever by a choice I made. And then, you know, I'll be crying to my manager, my best friend, and be like, I would think that they would know my heart, that they would know me.
Yes.
And sometimes you don't get given that grace because people think that. And yes, a huge responsibility comes with being in the spotlight and having a very public-facing career. But it's also the heartbreak of folks wanting to demand more of you than you're capable of giving and affording you less grace than they would do a regular person.
Wow.
And then also, you cannot remain the same person that you were beforehand. I think one of the hardest things for me was boundaries, because I always was like, everybody's my best friend. And then I've learned that that's not true. And you can't be, and you know, I think a hard part was for me to discover that really some relationships were transactional.
Shit, man.
Some folks think clout could be transferred over. It doesn't happen that way. Trust me. I call my followers and my readers my mangoes.
Yeah.
My mangoes don't care. They don't care about half of the stuff I do. They just want the poems. And so sometimes, you know, and so a lot of that happens. And I've entered relationships with romantic relationships or friendships thinking that they're genuine. And then it isn't that.
Damn.
And, but I'm in a place in my career where I think I've come to terms with a lot of that. But, yeah. From 2019 to maybe 2022 was really painful, because it was like relearning that over and over, and, having, just bumping into a lot of things that I was refusing to accept had changed. And then also, like, it's hard because you feel like there's an expectation. So, I'm really against, you know how people are like, move in silence?
Yeah.
I don't do that.
Well, no. See, I was going to say that doesn't run anything with
well,
me.
Well, I don't think I'm capable of doing that. Same. Like, you know how hard it is for me to not tell people of like, everything about my new book, but like, I can't legally. So like, I guess you just got to slap me with NDAs all the time. but I just love sharing everything, because my career is possible because of folks, because of community. Everything I've received is because of my community.
Yeah.
But I also learned that I have to protect myself sometimes too, because not everybody's community.
Right. Damn.
And although I move from a place of love and abundance,
yeah,
it doesn't minimize that if I protect myself a little bit. And so in that article where I was talking about that, I was really in the blues of that.
Yeah.
In the growing pains of realizing that how I had operated when I was a CVS cashier, can't be the way that I operate now.
That you're a public figure with wild success.
Do you know how hard it is for me to not say the street name I live on? And then my manager yells at me all the time. So I'm always trying to be as vague as possible. And because I just want to share everything.
Yeah.
And it's really painful for me to not be able to. And, but I'm really grateful that that's a problem I have to figure out with. I'd rather that problem than the problem of, does anybody care about what I'm writing?
True. Well, luckily, a lot of people do.
Mm.
And I am one of them. And hopefully so are our viewers. And I'm extremely thankful you being here.
Thank you. Before we
go, I know you say Mentirosa is coming out. Is there anything you can promote or tell us where to follow you? Give us all the promo stuff.
I mean, yeah. I can tell you that Mentirosa will come out soon.
Okay.
Like soon-ish, hopefully next year. But so keep an eye out for that. And also, I share everything on social media. I'm around.
Give us your handles.
I'm very much around. So you can find me on Instagram, on Threads.
Threads, you're big time.
And,
yeah, for some reason, the Threads one is where I'm always connected to you. Yeah.
X got weird, so I moved over to Threads. But I was a big Twitter girl.
Of course.
Yeah, but you can find me
at
Jessica Starr, YESIKASTARR. And then, or Jessica Salgado Poetry on TikTok, which I'm working on. I get yelled at a lot for not posting on there. Or my website, jessicasalgado.com.
There you go.
Yeah.
But the wonderful, the powerful, the resonant, and the beautiful Jessica Salgado. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for also loving the city like I do. And I learned so much from your page too.
Thank you.
I'm sending it always to my sisters. I'm like, did you know this? So yeah. Thank you.
We got to do a Salvadorian Corridor episode together.
Oh, we do.
Let's,
I got to take you to eat some pupusas.
Let's go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jessica. And make sure you get Mentirosa when it comes out. But in the meantime, Corazon is awesome. And again, I want to say, as somebody who is not, you know, Mr. Poetry, it's so accessible. It's meaningful. It's easy to digest. And it's like hip hop, you know, for somebody like me, it's like reading hip hop. So I appreciate that. Corazon, Teosoro, and Hermosa are the three books. So, but we're waiting for Mentirosa. So,
yes.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
Yes, of course.
All right, LA. It's been a minute.
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try MaintainX for free today. Go to MaintainX.com/AI. That's maintain in the letter X.com/AI.
At Vistaprint, we know you've got that idea for your business. Like the one that nails the trade show, levels up your brand, or makes your team say,
"We're really doing this."
But an idea is just an idea until it's printed on
signage, giveaways, custom apparel.
Once it's
in my hands, on my team, out in the world,
then it's happening.
It's so happening.
Vistaprint has thousands of products, easy design tools, and real support to turn that idea into something possible. Print your possible with code NEW20 for 20% off your first order at Vistaprint.com.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Disney refreshing!
The journey? It starts here, at your local ballpark. On the fields where dreams are born.
All right, fellas, here we go.
Every swing, every step, every moment, it all counts. The fundamentals kids learn today, they build the skills and confidence for tomorrow. Pitch, hit, and run. Find a local competition near you and sign up at pitchhitrun.com. Let the journey begin. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.